Good evening, Ajahn. I actually wanted to ask, like, before, how we are born, how actually the universe started.
Okay, let's start off with the easy questions first. It wasn't started. It doesn't have a discernible beginning. The idea that everything has to have a beginning is a mistaken assumption. So the Buddha, do you know how long an aeon is? An aeon or a kalpa? So if you imagine a stone mountain, like hard stone, like one yojana, it's maybe 12 kilometers long, 12 kilometers wide, 12 kilometers high, and once every 100 years, a man with a feather comes along and brushes it against the side of the stone mountain. So how long would it take for that stone mountain to erode because of the feather? That's one kalpa. And the Buddha could remember kalpa after kalpa, innumerable number of kalpas. So the Buddha said he cannot recall, there's no discernible beginning. So you see, the Buddha is so wise, he never says, there is no beginning. But what he says is, I can remember innumerable number of kalpas, and I've not found a beginning. So he says, no beginning is to be found. So I think this very interesting idea, you know, this idea of beginning, where does that come from? Why do we think there has to be a beginning? Is there anything, if we see like a cup or anything, yeah, okay, that has a beginning in the sense that it was produced in a factory and now it's a cup. But what was it produced from? You know, there had to be something for it to be produced from. And where does that come from? Can you find a beginning? When you say, okay, Big Bang. But where did Big Bang come from? It has to come from something. So we can't find a beginning of anything, even the constituents of a cup, let alone the universe. Yeah.
Namo Buddhaya, Ajahn Jayasaru. I want to check with you in terms of the concept of being mindful compared to being careful, because I feel that when I experience it and try to experiment on it, it has a different impact in terms of negativity and positivity of the mind. But I've been trying to ask a few of my friends in Kalyana Mitras, but if there are any deeper understanding about this difference between mindful and careful. Thank you.
Yes, quite big difference. Being careful would be, let's say, one of the expressions of mindfulness. If you are mindful, then you are present to something, you are able to sustain awareness on an object or on a recollection or on a physical sensation. But the opposite of being careful, being careless, and to be careless means a lack of attention. But again, what exactly do we mean by being careful? That word is somewhat ambiguous. I'm going around in circles here, maybe. But the important point about mindfulness in the Buddhist understanding of this term is that it has an ethical dimension. That there is has to be a sense of what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. What is right, what is wrong, in the mind, accompanying that mindfulness. So, for instance, you can't mindfully rob a bank. You could be very, very careful that nobody hears. You're so totally careful about what you're doing. But that wouldn't be considered mindfulness because what you're actually, but the meaning of what you're doing, the significance of what you're doing is that you are, you're taking something that's not given. You're acting in an immoral fashion. So that would not be considered to be mindfulness or right mindfulness in the Buddhist formulation of that term. So mindfulness is something of a kind of a minefield right now because mindfulness has become adopted and being used in so many different ways. So with a lot of these questions, we end up coming back to this kind of nitty-gritty things of defining terms because a lot of the arguments come because people are using words in different ways. So we have to define what we mean. So I would mean careful. This means like you've decided to do something and you're careful about not making mistakes in what you're doing. But with mindfulness, then there is a selection. You know, there is an ethical dimension to it. So you could be careful about something which is unethical, but you can't be mindful of being unethical. Is that clear anyway? Yeah. You see, you could do something. Commit a crime and then be very careful to clear up after you. Be very careful that nobody knows who did it. But that wouldn't be being mindful in the Buddhist sense.
Sawadee Ajahn, I have a question about meditations. So when talking about observing our mind and our emotion, it's quite easy to understand positive or negative emotion when they arise. But how about the neutral emotion, the non-positive or non-negative? For me, what does that mean when that type of emotion arises? And is it harmful? Is it not harmful? And what does it mean to have that neutral, blank emotion or understand that emotion?
First of all, remember that the word emotion, we cannot map that onto Pali language exactly. Even in Western psychology, there are differences of opinion about what an emotion is. So sometimes we can use emotion just in a more loose way. But when we start talking about the mind and practice, we have to be very much more precise. So there is three kinds of feeling or vetana. So you have positive, or you could say happy feeling, unhappy feeling, and neutral feeling. But with the emotion or the what we call defilements or kusala dhammas and akusala dhammas, there's not a third neutral factor here. So something is either kusala or it's akusala. It can't be in between. But you can have an accompanying feeling tone to the kusala or akusala dhamma, which may be positive or negative or neutral. So if you, let's say if you're, I would say the way that I use emotion is when a mental state has a very clear set of physical, like a physical pattern of arousal, which is specific to that mental state. And then we can talk about emotion. So let's say anger. So when you're angry, there are certain kind of physiological changes that can be observed which accompany anger in a way that certain mental states do not possess. So then I think, although that's not present in Buddhist psychology, that's quite a useful addition to our vocabulary to talk about these particular mind-body combinations that can be objects of observation. But in the case of anger, I was talking about anger again, so to some young people this afternoon, and why is anger difficult to abandon? And we can only really abandon anger when we observe the pleasure that we experience in anger. There's a exhilaration in anger. So, for instance, if you're, again, this point about power and powerlessness, if you're someone who's powerless, a child or a student or a woman throughout most of history and most cultures, you're in a position where people don't take you seriously. What do you know? You're just a kid. And what do you know? You're just an outsider. What do you know? You're just a woman. And perhaps the only time that people ever take you seriously is when you show anger. And so if you're someone who usually is accustomed to not being taken seriously, and then when you're taken seriously, you suddenly, this is power. You notice people's reactions and people start to take you seriously. And that's the drug. That's the hit. That's the anger hit. That's the exhilaration. That's the power that you feel. It's like a drug. So when you're angry, then you can be experiencing pleasure in that kind of exhilaration in the anger, that excitement and arousal of anger. But you can also be experiencing, it's very unpleasant. But there can also be periods where there's a kind of neither one or the other. It's kind of a neutral thing. So feeling tone of emotion can fluctuate. There can be mainly a negative feeling, mainly a positive feeling, more a neutral feeling. But this is something separate from the emotion itself, or the anger itself. So this is why it's kind of subtle thing for. But I wouldn't. The point you made is we know when we have positive and negative emotions. I don't think that's necessarily true. That we can be blind to certain emotions, and we can constantly actually repress. You know, you see classic case of somebody's got red. I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed. Yes, it's like.
Good evening, Ajahn. I would like to ask about meditation. Let's say, for example, when you are having pain during meditation and you look into it, the pain, and then after a while you see the bones in the body. And then when you see the bones, you look at it in terms of impermanence. And after that, what to go forth after that? And if should you, every sitting, if there are pain, you look into it because it's very painful. How often?
Yeah, there are different views on this. My own view is that meditation is an exploration. We're learning about body and mind. Okay, so it's not just we're doing this in order to get that. We're exploring, we're learning. So we go beyond like a good meditation or a bad meditation. We're talking about a learning meditation. So maybe you can spend the whole meditation learning about sleepiness or dullness, but you have that intention to learn, it's time well spent. Okay. Now, with one of the things that we all need to learn as human beings, we need to study and learn and observe pain and what pain is, and what pain does to our minds, or how our minds can magnify pain, and how we add on to pain with resistance and fear and anxiety and anger and so on. So this should be one of the things that we learn from meditation. Most of our fear of death I think most people would say it's fear of what happens before death. It's not actually death that we are afraid of. And that's largely bound up with fear of pain. So dealing with pain in meditation and developing a skill in dealing with pain in meditation also reduces fear of death and gives us some, which is a wonderful thing. Looking at pain and learning about pain is hard work. And to sustain a meditation practice for weeks and months and years, as I mentioned just now, you have to find some way of enjoying it, basically enjoy. If meditation becomes this kind of, oh, here we go again, you know, now I've got to go and look at the pain and find the bones and the, you know, and the, you know, and it just becomes such a dreary business that before very long, depend on how strong your mind is, this is too much for me, yeah? And few people really can do that over and over again. So I would say that looking into pain is an important part of meditation practice, but don't do it too often. Sometimes, you know, when you're just feeling your mind's on the breath and you're feeling good and the pain comes, change your posture. It's okay. Because you're feeling like you're really going into this now and it's a distraction. And you don't have to do this work every time you meditate. You don't have to be like, I've got to be a good girl and I've got to do this pain thing and I've got to be tough. No. Have a sense of what's for your welfare, you know, big picture welfare, not just, just small term. So developing patience and meditations, what you've developed already is good. But don't think that that's what meditation is. Sometimes sit on a chair, change your posture. It's okay. Don't worry about it. There's a sutta where I can't. You'll have to excuse me. I give you this sort of the basic gist of it. I can't remember exactly. But an arahant is asked, "How did you realize stream entry?" And so, well, I saw the rupa, body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, vijnana, consciousness arise and pass away according to. I saw the impermanence, the dukkha, the anatta of the five khandhas. So, okay, after you were a sotapanna, how did you realize the second level, once returner? I investigated the five khandhas to see impermanence, dukkha, anatta. Okay, then after you realize, how did you realize non-returner? I investigated the five khandhas to see the... So the point being... that there's no new practice or more profound practice. It's just deepening what you're doing already. So if you can visualize the bones and you're seeing the bones as not being self and you're investigating impermanent or dukkha or anatta, either one of those, just keep doing it. That you're doing the right thing already. Yeah.
Maybe Ajahn, I also have a question. For many of us who are working, we find it difficult to balance career advancement and spiritual practice. Mm. Especially for those who are starting to develop their career, our mind is preoccupied with developing this career and so much time is put into it that we feel exhausted by the end of the day and we just want to relax, especially on weekends also when it's time to come to the temple and therefore we don't really come to the temple as much. So what is Ajahn's advice to us?
Yeah, there's no... I think that this whole question of balance is... it's not confined to lay Buddhists. It's one of the most common questions that come up with bhikkhus and nuns also. The balance between offering your services to the sangha and following your own meditation practice, between work projects and meditation, this is a constant challenge. And even if you think you've got it worked out for a while, then things change. You know, so maybe you think you just got worked out, and then your company absorbs another company, or your company goes bust, and you have to get a new job, or you find you're pregnant, you're gonna have a baby, and you know these so many different things. It's not like now I've got it sorted out, the work-life balance, and that's it. Just maintain this, because life is not stable; it's changing all the time, and you just do the best you can. But there is a I think there is a point where you do have to prioritize. So if you're in your 20s and your 30s, then this is the time to be putting a lot of effort into your career. But not to abandon your Dhamma practice. But I've been giving a few tips to try and broaden your ideas of what Dhamma practice is today. But then as you you know, as you get more senior and you get a little bit older, then maybe you're thinking, well, I don't need to go right to the top of the tree. I go as far as I can go in a way which is supportive of my Dhamma practice. So these are choices that you have to make, and there's not a right choice or a wrong choice, but the question is, how important, where do I put my Dhamma practice? So now you may be thinking, well, I could do this, I could expand here, I could take on that, it would mean more income, but how important to me is more income? And maybe you say, well, I don't need more income, I'm quite comfortable. So we don't want to get onto this kind of thing like you've got to get to the top to be a success. And don't want to measure yourself in that way. But there's also something to be admired in someone who pursues a path and takes it as far as they can. And I think it's also very meritorious for people who are following a path of Dhamma to also be successful in the world as a way of showing, yes, to be a Dhamma practitioner doesn't mean you just give up on the world and you go off to a monastery, because this is still an idea which is prevalent in society. But showing, yeah, you can be honest and you can be kind and moral and ethical and you can be mindful and you can be a success in the world as well. But the thing is not to be measuring your success in the eyes of the world or in other people, or just feeling driven to do this because your friend who graduated the same year as you is making more money than you, and you've got to get the same size house or the same little car. Or, you know, that don't want to be thinking like that. But if you have this interest in building something and really putting yourself into it, and creating a company and something that's providing something for society, I don't see anything wrong with that. But it's not the same as being in a monastery, for sure. You know, you can't have your cake and eat it. You know, there are certain compromises, and you say, but you should have like a bottom line. Bottom line is five precepts. Bottom line is you should try, no matter how busy, to schedule at least like a 1 week retreat every year, at least, and have odd periods like weekends every now and again where you can go off and be quiet, or to offer service to the temple or to your meditation group or to Nalanda group. So these things, you have to schedule them in. You have to make time for them. Especially when you're in the 20s and 30s where things are going fast, you have to be very disciplined and say, I'm going to put this much time aside. And I don't care if I'm peaceful or I'm not peaceful, I'm just going to do this and make a commitment to do it. Yeah. Yes, there's somebody over there.
Ajahn, can Ajahn elaborate more on only a happy mind can comprehend dukkha? And if we think we are suffering, we cannot understand dukkha. Thank you.
Yes, okay. Simply, when we are suffering, then, or when the mind is weak, we can say, then whenever we... Let's say when there is an unpleasant object, our natural instinct is to retreat from it or to try to destroy it or get rid of it or to turn our back on it. And unless we are free of that instinctive habit, we cannot see that thing clearly. So let me give you an analogy. You know, before the development of anesthetic, local anesthetic, surgery was very primitive. Surgery was only able to reach the level of sophistication that we see today because we could anesthetize patients. And you have to anesthetize the mind before you can use the scalpel and look at it very clearly. So if the mind is weak and unhappy, when it comes in, has an unpleasant object, then it can't be with it. It just cannot deal with it. But when you have a happy mind, a happy mind here means it's stable, it's clear, there's a sense of well-being and energy in the mind, then it's able just to be there with it. It doesn't feel threatened by it. So, okay, I'm trying to think of a simile. Let's say you're like a big elephant and you're just walking through the forest, and then there's little puppies come out and start biting your feet, you know, and you just look, you know, it's like little puppies trying to bite me. So that's like the happy mind. It's like the big elephant. And the sort of aggressive little puppies are like the negative impact. Yeah. So if you're just a small mouse or an angry squirrel, then you meet that same pack of angry puppies and it's a whole different experience. I don't know if that's a clear enough analogy. It's me. But I like the analogy of this big elephant and these kind of angry puppies. That's what you should go for, yeah, happy mind. So the thing about suffering, you know, suffering, the first noble truth, should be comprehended. But there may many people say, well, yeah, I know when I'm suffering. What's the enlightening the nature of that? Yeah, no, it's different. You think, I am suffering. But if the sense is, I am suffering, then you're not observing the noble truth of suffering. You're identifying with the suffering. It's something that's happening to me. It's my problem. But the comprehension of the noble truth of suffering arises in the absence of that sense of self. And identification or possession of the suffering.
Good evening, Ajahn. I'd like to ask some questions on the area of offering of dana. Mm-hmm. At the start of this talk, Ajahn mentioned about this layperson's offering of a first-class ticket to Ajahn and travel this in a first-class environment. Is it something that we, as a layperson, have to learn in terms of making the offering of dana? How much and under what circumstances? And is that a stop that we have to end? Thank you.
Yes, certainly. Then, of course, the generous impulse is meritorious, but we need to use wisdom and discretion as to exactly how we express that, what is offered, when it's offered, where it's offered, to whom it's offered. All these things we need to think about well. For instance, to offer requisites or offer things which are inappropriate for a monk to make use of, which if he were to use, were to entail breaking his precepts, then even though you offered with great generosity and with a pure heart, then it wouldn't be a wise offering, and there wouldn't be as much merit involved as in offering something which was appropriate and in the right amount and the right time, right place, right monk. So, yeah, there is a need to not just, you know, because it just feels so great, you know, to when there's someone that you look up to and you revere to make an offering, and it feels, it's a wonderful feeling, but it should, there is also a need to just step back and just to consider what is the best way to express this feeling of devotion, or to what kind of offering. So many people, in Thailand, for instance, you know, forest monks, like I use a robe, like this robe lasts maybe a couple of years, and it's a white cotton robe which is dyed with a natural heart jackfruit dye. So every year I'm offered, I don't know, a hundred or more robes of different colors of synthetic materials, which I would never make use of. So that person is offering because they've read in the suttas that it's great merit to offer robes to a monk. So in that sense, you know, they've made the offering, and it's not wrong. And I will send it on to other monasteries so he can say it's still effective offering. But it's better if, like with monasteries, that you speak to the abbot and you say, is there anything that the monastery particularly short of at the moment? You know, I want to make this, I don't want to make things that you can't, just because they're things that people usually offer, but I'd like to offer something that would be definitely of value to the monastery. I'm probably the same as all of you. If there's a sort of a senior monk, you know, like in Thailand, you know, people offer monks foods that they would never eat themselves, not because they don't like them, but because they're too expensive. I would never eat that. You know, it's just too much. But if it's like to offer to a monk, then they would get joy from that. So as a monk, sometimes you feel a little bit awkward in the sense that, one, you feel like, I feel like that myself. You know, if I want to make an offering to someone, and, you know, I get something someone gives to me and I think, oh, this is so good, I must offer it to one of my teachers. You know, you want to give the best to the people that you look up to. It's a natural desire. So I was speaking as a monk, then sometimes you feel people have spent a lot of money on something which was not really necessary, and yet they derive great joy from it. So it's a difficult question of whether or not to say something. I mean, I remember many years ago, I was staying in a small hermitage, and I'd walk on arms round every day, And there was nobody living or cooking for me. And there was no fruit on Bindabat. And yet I walked through past these papaya trees, and they were like dead papaya. They were not dead, like papayas rotting on the ground. And, you know, I think, oh, why don't they just offer me, so, you know, rather than letting it just go to rot, let the flies eat it. You know, but you can't say that as a monk. You're not allowed to. And then one of the wealthier people in the village, it was some kind of holiday or something, and they went to the market and they bought this huge Australian apple, which must, in those days, this is 20 years ago, really expensive and totally tasteless. And I can think, you know, here's just someone who's just, you know, they're so proud that they bought me like an imported fruit, which is so expensive. And they offer it, you know, and they just, you know, just, you can see they're so happy. And I'm thinking, I would have much preferred one of the papaya, just like laying on the ground outside, you know. So yeah, it's not always that the most expensive is the best, and it's good just to be observant also in monasteries and, you know, what actually is useful. And I think that's a good thing for lay people to learn, and that it's not always that the most expensive is the best. Although, as I say, we tend to have this. I have at least this thing, want to give the best to the people that we look up to and revere.
One last question.
Yes,
sorry. Tanajan. Wanted to ask, is there a Mahadana explanation for the 8 and 10 precepts?
Is there?
Yeah.
No. When we increase the 5 precepts to 8 precepts, then the intention is to simplify and to create optimum conditions for Dhamma practice. So it's the 5 precepts are more about living in community in the best possible way and giving this sense of safety and security to those around us. But when we take on 8 precepts on the full moon, dark moon, or on meditation retreats, it's that we don't eat in the evening. I mean, it's not evil to eat in the evening, you know. It's not like imposing on anybody. But by not eating in the evening, it means we have more time to meditate. Stomach is empty. It's helpful for meditation. And give up all the entertainments and embellishments and, you know, just to focus wholly on the practice of Dhamma. So these are simplifying and clarifying our intentions, freeing up time for Dhamma practice. It's a slightly different intention from 5 precepts.
Do you mind if I ask one more? Okay. There is a saying or something that the way of the world, there's one way of the world, and then the way to transcendence is the other.
Sorry, say that again.
There's like the way of the world, there is one way, yeah. And the way to liberation is another way. Is yeah. that how do you reconcile that with the earlier question which you were saying?
Another kind of big topic. Probably could give a whole talk on that. But what I would say is that we are living in a something like a Dharma-ending age, and an age where we're threatened with extinction of the whole planet, etc., etc. And yet, at the same time, this is a golden age in terms of lay Buddhist access to teachings. You can sit in your car and you say, "Oh yeah, today I'd like to listen to an arahant while I'm driving to work," you know, and you press a button. Don't like that arahant, you can change and listen to a different arahant. And I mean, this is like beyond the wildest dreams of anybody for the past, even for monks, to have that kind of opportunity to listen to the Dhamma. And for all the faults of a capitalist economy and capitalist development, and we know there's so many problems that arise attendant on this kind of development, it does give people choices that they've never had before in history. There's no question that this is the best time in history of the world to be a woman. Absolutely. The women have opportunity to study, whether it's worldly study, but study the Dhamma, to practice in ways that women have never had before. And in the past, by the time you're 17, 18, you've probably got a child already, and you're a mother, and that's it for you, raising children, which is fine, but, it means that your choices are much restricted. Whereas these days, you can get married, you don't have to get married if you don't want to. You can even have a child without a partner these days. There's just so the opportunities are endless. But now, if you want to spend your life making money and becoming rich and powerful, you can try that. But if you say, no, I want to practice Dhamma, so what kind of career do I choose, kind of way of life which would be most conducive to practice of Dhamma, you can do that as well. This is incredible. So the distinction between monastic life and lay life, which we find in the suttas, that's not the case anymore. There's not this huge gulf between the life of a monastic and the life of a lay person, or at least lay people have the opportunity and the possibility of living a life which has many of the features of monastic life, if they wish to do that. So the way of the world and the way, I don't think it's so clear cut as it used to be at all. Yeah.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.